The Philadelphia Orchestra musician strike lasted just 2 days, but an important 2 days. It was the season opening weekend, and all concerts were canceled. Now that the strike's over, the orchestra is making amends to its audience. I'm Brad Linder, and this is Newsworks Tonight. Dave Heller's off this evening. From WHYY's Arts and Culture Desk, Peter Crimmins reports on what happens now.
A representative of the musicians says they did not want to strike, but felt they had to in order to resolve contract disagreements. John Cohen, chairman of the musicians' committee, says they want to help the orchestra with its money problems.
We can agree to send musicians to play for free at parties where they intend to raise money. And, you know, this will also give donors and, you know, potential donors or potentially really big donors a nice opportunity to interact with the artists who make up the Philadelphia Orchestra.
The strike did not help the orchestra's public relations. During the Friday walkout, some patrons who bought tickets to a concert that never happened were upset with the musicians. Executive Vice President Ryan Fluor hopes trust can be repaired because the strike was over in just 2 days, unlike the last strike 20 years ago, which lasted 2 months.
Whenever you have essentially a bad customer service experience, which is what, unfortunately, a number of our patrons experience, we have to double down and demonstrate our worthiness. We have to do it all together, holding hands, musicians, board, staff. And we've begun conversations about how that can take place.
The musicians have organized an audience appreciation day, wherein they'll break up into small ensembles and play free pop-up concerts in different places around town on Tuesday. While it's not an official orchestra event, the musicians created this themselves, management is supporting the day of concerts. I'm Peter Crimmins, WHYY News.
An area nonprofit says Sunny census data released last month hides some dark numbers about child poverty in the Philadelphia suburbs, according WHYY's Laura Benchoff reports that the number of impoverished children in Montgomery, Bucks, Delaware, and Chester counties is greater than during the depths of the Great Recession.
In September, the U.S. Census released annual American Community Survey data detailing things like household income. In general, the picture was a pretty good one for Philadelphia suburbs. Donna Cooper, Executive Director of Public Citizens for Children and Youth, says that picture doesn't tell the whole story.
Child poverty has continued to be a problem in the suburbs, rising during the recession, dipping a little bit now, but still, there are 7,000 more children in poverty today than in the worst years of the recession.
After crunching the numbers, her group will be rolling out reports on the four suburban counties. The first focuses on Delaware County, which the Philadelphia Inquirer reported had a banner year for household income growth in 2015. Cooper says, despite that growth, more kids in Delaware County qualified for subsidized school lunches than during the recession, and not just in places that are historically disadvantaged.
The percentage of low-income children grew most in districts that historically had the fewest children who were low-income.
As an advocacy group, Public Citizens for Children and Youth tied census numbers to policies it promotes, such as raising the minimum wage. Temple University Urban Studies professor and group board member Carolyn Adams says kids are left behind when their parents don't make enough money.
Access to jobs is such a problem in this metropolitan area.
The advocacy group says a lack of social policy protections for children, compared with anti-poverty measures for, say, seniors, another vulnerable group, also contributes to higher poverty among kids. Laura Benchoff, WHYY News.
Hurricane Matthew is in the Caribbean, but it's expected to continue north. While it's unclear how the East Coast will be affected, any storm of this size triggers memories of Hurricane Sandy in 2012. While the Jersey Shore received most of the attention after the storm, parts of the Delaware Bay were also severely impacted, and work is underway to better protect fragile habitat in that region. Mark Eichmann reports from the Delaware Desk.
A large backhoe offloads a delivery of rock from a nearby barge in Mispillion Harbor east of Milford. It's delicate work for the operator of the big machine that also must fight winds and waves on the water to deliver the rock. The rock's being used to better fortify a rock wall that protects Mispillion Harbor from the Delaware Bay. The harbor connects the Mispillion River to the Delaware Bay and is also a prime spot for horseshoe crabs.
This is a really critical spot for horseshoe crabs, red knots, and also there's birders that come out here and other ecotourism.
Jeremy Ash is Delaware's Habitat Restoration Project Manager along the Delaware Bay shore. He says this habitat is threatened by storms, especially nor'easters that overtop the rock wall designed to protect this harbor.
Every time there's a coastal storm, a nor'easter, the water actually goes over the rock wall. And every time the water goes over the rock wall, it causes more and more erosion of back beach, which is the specific habitat for the horseshoe crab and red knot. And we've seen increased habitat loss every year in every coastal storm.
To improve the protection of the harbor and the beach, workers are doubling the height of the rock wall using giant rocks called R7s. Those rocks are placed on top of a filter fabric and smaller rocks that are designed to stop the water from coming through the wall. When the giant R7s are placed on top, they create a locking mechanism to block the water. Once the rocks are in place, more than 4,000 dump trucks will deliver more than 46,000 cubic yards of sand. That extra sand will create a beach on the backside of the rock wall, a beach that could become home for thousands of horseshoe crabs.
And that's going to create over 4 acres of potential habitat for horseshoe crabs, which will spawn and then provide that habitat for red knots and a variety of other shorebirds.
The project is funded with Hurricane Sandy relief money, in part because of the damage that storm did here. And as bad as hurricanes are, nor'easters often cause more damage.
During a nor'easter, we're going to have waves coming from the northeast direction, and currently there is no rock to withstand that force. So every time there's a nor'easter, water's rushing through a breach. There's actually a breach to the north of the rock wall, and we're getting these large waves and large erosion on every nor'easter.
The project is part of the state's Bay Shore Initiative, a program to improve the coastal area along the Delaware Bay.
These are the restoration components of the Bay Shore Initiative. So once we restore the habitat, we want to be able to allow the future generations and future people to come out and enjoy these habitats.
Because the area is a sensitive habitat for horseshoe crabs and a stopover for migrating red knots, the work must be completed no later than April 15th, when those species are expected to return. DENREC expects to be done by February, well ahead of time. From the Delaware Desk, I'm Mark Eichmann, WHYY News.
According to a survey of Children's Health in Delaware, too many kids in the first state are overweight and too few of their parents realize it. From WHYY's Health Desk, Tanya English reports.
The director of Delaware's Division of Public Health, Carol Rite, says the survey suggests an improvement in healthy habits.
Children appear to be consuming less sugar-sweetened beverages, which is great. We also are seeing a slight increase in physical activity among our children.
That's good news. But Rite says so far, those healthy habits have not translated into a drop in obesity. The number of overweight and obese children in Delaware is holding steady at 36%. Dr. Colleen Witherell cares for kids at Nemours Pediatrics in Wilmington. Often it's a surprise when she tells moms and dads their child is obese.
You know, that image of the cute baby with the really chubby cheeks and rolls of fat is often considered healthy. Now, over time, we're realizing some of those children continue to keep those rolls as they get older, and then at that point, it's not healthy.
Witherell says she hopes Delaware will work to create more places for children to exercise. Right now, about 60% of surveyed parents said they live in a neighborhood that's definitely safe enough for children to play outside. I'm Tanya English, WHYY News.
Still ahead, 400 years later, and we're still talking about Don Quixote.
It continues to this day to be something that is really captivating.
Rediscovering Cervantes, that's coming up as Newsworks Tonight continues on WHYY. Recently, astronomers discovered Proxima B, a planet in a nearby galaxy that could have liquid water. Well, a much closer and much more familiar heavenly body may also have an ocean on it, even if it's not visible. Dave Heller talked space water with Derek Pitts, chief astronomer at the Franklin Institute.
Derek, we're going to go all the way out to tiny Pluto today.
Now, we know that it's generally 3.6 billion miles away from the sun. We know it's incredibly cold out there. The temperatures, you know, range down to 350 degrees below zero. Yet here we are with a data that suggests that there is perhaps a small ocean of water beneath the frozen surface crust of Pluto.
Water, H2O.
Water, H2O.
Water, liquid, not frozen?
Water, liquid, not frozen.
Where does the data come from?
Well, the data comes from an analysis of the physical relationship between Pluto and its major moon, Charon. We could actually think of Pluto and Charon as a double planet system because they are so close to each other in size. As we look at the motion of Charon as it orbits around Pluto, what we see is that there's some motion that can't be accounted for unless you could allow for the body of a liquid, much like water, to exist just below the surface of Pluto in a very specific location.
Trapped beneath the surface, or over millennia, is it evaporating?
This seems to be very much like a number of the other moons that we see out in the far reaches of the solar system, moons both at Jupiter and Saturn, where we have a frozen crust of ice, underneath of which we find these bodies of water. So at Pluto, we're seeing something that's similar to that, where we have a frozen surface, but a body of water underneath, similar to what we might see in Antarctica here on Earth, where we know there's an ice cap there at the South Pole, but we know there's an extraordinarily large lake of liquid water frozen deep beneath that layer of ice.
Amazing. I suspect, though, that long before we learn more about that body of water, we're going to get more information about our nearest neighbor, Mars.
I suspect we are going to do that, too. In the next 2 decades, if we listen to what Elon Musk has to say, it might be that there will be people there within the next decade and a half actually digging into the soil of Mars, providing more information than the rovers that are already there.
Tell me more. What does Elon Musk have to say?
Well, last week, Elon Musk laid out a very, very elaborate plan. Now, when you look at what he said, he didn't really talk about how people that would be sent to Mars in his interplanetary space system would be cared for. He didn't talk about their safety. He didn't talk about any of those things. He didn't talk very much about the risk involved. But he instead laid out a very, very interesting engineering architecture for how to get very, very large payloads from Earth out to Mars with a fairly regular schedule. He's suggesting that his launch system would be prepared to send payloads to Mars every 26 months. And that 26 months recognizes the time at which the orbital cycles of Mars and Earth bring the two close enough together to make the shortest possible trip.
The idea then is to have a habitable space in place to then greet whatever human visitors go there?
Yeah, so he's foreseeing the possibility of sending equipment to Mars that once on the surface could turn itself into all the equipment and facilities needed to establish a base autonomously, and then send people afterwards to populate that base. He's projecting the possibility of there being 1 million people on Mars in 50 years. Now, he's not saying that every detail is in place about this. It's not asking governments to participate. It's not demanding industry or anybody else participate. But it's opening the doors to opportunities for partnerships with others who might have the same dream.
Thanks, Derek.
My pleasure, Dave.
Derek Pitts, chief astronomer at the Franklin Institute. He joins us each week at this time on NewsWorks Tonight.
Space is the place. Space is the place.
Don Quixote is a book many people consider to be the first novel written in the Western world. Its author, Miguel Cervantes, died 4 centuries ago. In fact, 2016 is the 400th anniversary of his death, but his works live on. This weekend, Philadelphia Renaissance Music Ensemble Pífaro will perform 2 concerts representing the musical world of Don Quixote, and Pífaro's Grant Hera joins us in the studio. Thanks for being here.
My great pleasure. Thank you.
Also joining us is Princeton professor Marina Brownlee. She's organizing and moderating a related symposium at the University of Pennsylvania on Saturday. Professor Brownlee, thanks for being here.
Thank you. My pleasure.
So 400 years, it's a long time. Why are we still talking about Don Quixote after all this time?
Well, there are a lot of reasons why people are still obsessed by the Quixote. I mean, throughout the ages, famous authors have written about it. Famous artists have dealt with it. Musicians. It's also fascinating in terms of madness, which appeals to all kinds of people in a lot of ways. Freud was captivated by the book in terms of the transition from mania to depression. It was a time Cervantes and his cohort were for the first time looking at madness seriously. That is to say, prior ages had thought that, okay, people are mad, you deal with them, you box them away and they're not human. And they realized, in fact, artists and authors went and studied in people in mental institutions because they realized that there is a lot of humanity in terms of the way people react, in terms of human subjectivity and all of that. Faulkner said that he would read the Quixote once a year the way many people would read the Bible. And Malraux said that people who had been in concentration camps and in prisons should have this as required reading. So it continues to this day to be something that is really captivating.
So it's not just a question of it's the first time somebody wrote a book-length piece of fiction in the Western world, but also that the themes resonate and continue on till to today. So it's a good piece of fiction.
Absolutely, and in so many ways.
And in terms of music, Cervantes fills his book with episodes of shepherds singing in the hills, of sort of courtly music making, of elegant masks and dance. It just abounds with music, and that's what we're exploring in the concert part of the festival.
Right, and I wanted to talk to you about that. We're talking about a festival here. We're talking about a book, but we're talking about music. What's the relationship between those when you're reading a piece of literature? How do you get this sense of the music of it and then perform it?
Well, that's maybe the main reason why we're doing this, the musical part, is because when you are reading the book and you come across these musical examples, musical scenes, it's hard to imagine what the music sounded like. And so what we are trying to do is give the audience a real auditory sort of tour of the novel and really fill the cathedral space with the sounds that Cervantes put into this book.
And so, I mean, the time period we're talking about here is the early 17th century. And when people sort of think about music that's hundreds of years old, they're often thinking big orchestra movements, and a lot of that actually came later. But what is an ensemble like yours? What kind of instruments do you perform? What's the music like?
Right. We specialize in music from 400 years ago. So we're not talking about orchestras. We're talking about the really soft sounds of the plucked lute and vihuela, an early kind of guitar. This is the time when the guitar itself in the early 17th century was becoming an important instrument. And you'll hear some strumming guitar music that sounds a little bit like the roots of flamenco music. You'll hear various percussion instruments from North Africa, so bringing in the Moorish influence in Spain. And, of course, the courtly shams and sackbuts, the early double reeds and early trombones and early bassoons that were the sort of mainstay of the courtly musical and chapel musical establishments of the time.
So, you know, here we are again talking about a work whose legacy has lived on for hundreds of years as people have been influenced by it, have shaped the way that a lot of literature and music and other things have really evolved in all this time. Looking ahead 400 years, do you think we're still going to be talking about Don Quixote, or are we going to be talking about something entirely different at that point?
I think Don Quixote is going to still be a hot topic, and that is because there's something about the character, something about the other characters, the way the book is put together. It's about human subjectivity. It's about sex and gender, race, ethnicity, nationhood, madness, you name it. These are things that are always going to be issues for societies, and I think that's why whether or not you're interested in the neo-Aristotelian controversy of 16th century literary academies, maybe not so much, but these issues have always gripped readers and auditors, and they're going to continue to do so.
Marina Brownlee is professor of Spanish and Portuguese languages and cultures at Princeton University, and Grant Herod is a member of the Renaissance music group Piffero and project director of the musical world of Don Quixote. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you. Great pleasure.
This disclosure, Piffero supports WHYY. You can find more information about all of this weekend's events at our website, newsworks.org. Finally, today is Rosh Hashanah, the Jewish New Year. The Jewish calendar usually turns over in September, but during leap years it adds an extra month to keep pace with the slightly longer Gregorian calendar used in the secular world. Therefore, the holiday falls in October this year. It's traditionally celebrated with the blowing of a shofar, an instrument made from the horn of a ram, which marks a 10-day period of repentance for Jews, culminating in Yom Kippur, the Day of Atonement. The customary eating of apples and honey symbolizes the hope of a sweet new year. That's all for tonight. That's all for tonight's show. NewsWorks Tonight is produced by Shai Ben-Yaakov, Kimberly Haas, Ty Johnson, and Brett Rader. You can find us on iTunes or listen back at newsworks.org. Thanks for joining us. I'm Brad Linder for NewsWorks Tonight.